Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable. This week, the Liberal victory in Canada got widespread media attention in the United States media. Canadians ousted the right-wing Prime Minister Stephen Harper after he spent nearly a decade in power. Liberal leader Justin Trudeau will become Canada's next Prime Minister within a few weeks. Canada's elections have received widespread attention in the U.S., so how are the media reporting changes under Harper, and what is next with Trudeau in power? During a congratulatory phone call with President Obama, Justin Trudeau said that he will pull Canada out of the U.S.-led bombing campaign against ISIS in Syria and Iraq. Tim Harper is the national affairs columnist with Canada's Toronto Star. Tim has spent two decades in Canada reporting on politics there and another 6 years in Washington, D.C. covering politics. Hi, Tim. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Good. Thank you for joining us. And The Intercept recently published an explosive report about President Obama's assassination policies between 2011 and 2013. The documents were provided to The Intercept by a source within the intelligence community. According to these documents, during 1 5-month period between January 2012 and February 2013, nearly 90% of the people killed in airstrikes were not the intended targets. In Yemen and Somalia, where the U.S. has far more limited intelligence capabilities to confirm the people killed are the intended targets, the equivalent ratios may well be much worse. And joining us to talk about these documents is Andrew Coburn, Washington editor with Harper's Magazine. He just published a piece about these documents, and it is called Flying Bird. He writes, the authors of the drone papers were delivering a simple message, send more money, and we'll talk with him about that. Andrew is also author of Kill Chain, The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins. Hi, Andrew. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Great to be with you.
It's great to have you. So as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and congratulate a reporter who did a good job this week. Highlight a reporter who did a good job this week. So, Andrew Coburn, what did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I saw it was actually a terrific piece, since the internet is a great leveler. It's not in any of the mainstream papers, but the Fiscal Times had a great piece by David Dion about, I thought it was very instructive, the way lobbying and the way Washington really works, which is basically a big Wall Street operator, Carl Icahn, has invested $250 million to get Congress to change an obscure provision and a tax... Sorry, he's invested $150 million to get Congress to change an obscure provision in an impending tax bill, which he thinks will make him $250 million. So he's investing $150 million to make a $100 million profit. And I think, you know, people talk a lot about the huge amount of money going into the presidential campaigns. Here's something that no one else has noticed, which is going, you know, which is just the way that our politics gets bought. I just think David Dayen, D-A-Y-E-N, in the Fiscal Times. Look it up. It's really will teach you a lot about Washington, yeah, the way things really work.
We've had him on before. I actually saw this in the New York Times. And this billionaire, Carl Icahn, he announced on Twitter that he's going to support Donald Trump for president. He's starting a super PAC with this $150 million.
Well, that's, yeah, but this is the super PAC. You know, that's what gets the headline, that it's Donald Trump and everything. But the key point that Diane's pointing out is it's really about making Carl Icahn very promptly a lot of money, which is, you know, I've seen this in the past. There was a provision, the big banks clubbed together and invested the grand total of a mere $750,000 in a subcommittee of the Financial Services Committee of the House in 2009. To get a provision in the way they reported the value of their assets changed, that basically brought them a return of $4 billion immediately. So get an accounting rule change. So this is what people ought to be paying more attention to: the way our politics are actually manipulated to make people a lot of money. I mean, as you know, super PACs for Trump and are all very well, but that's just a distraction.
And Andrew, did you see the piece in the New York Times last week? I'm kind of surprised it hasn't gotten more attention. They reported that 158 families, along with the companies they own or control, and they've listed them, contributed $176 million in the first phase of the presidential election so far.
I did indeed. And it was interesting that most of them, you know, we hear a lot about big internet money, Silicon Valley, all these new sort of, you know, glamorous billionaires like Zuckerberg and people. But the most of them, I think, as the Times pointed out, and it was a terrific piece of investigation, pointed out that the bulk of the sort of very high contributors were actually old-fashioned in a way. It was energy money, oil and gas, and mostly from the South, mostly from Texas, mostly from a couple of districts in Houston and Dallas, as I recall.
Right.
Which I thought was pretty significant. And then the second largest bulk was, surprise, surprise, from Wall Street.
Right.
So I thought, again, we all, you know, people, as you say, that piece should have gotten much more attention than it did, because it really showed who's buying politics this time around.
Yeah. All right. So kudos to David Diane, and we will put links to that story and then this New York Times piece about these 158 families who are providing nearly half of all the money for efforts to capture the White House. That's Andrew Coburn. He's Washington editor with Harper's Magazine and author of Kill Chain, The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins. And what about you, Tim? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I'll go old school on you and go mainstream media. I know it got a lot of attention in the U.S. It did up here as well. There was a piece on the front of the New York Times last week entitled "The Lonely Death of George Beall," written by N.R. Kleinfield of the Times, and it chronicled from the moment this gentleman died alone in his apartment in New York, how his effects were disposed of, and it continued on to finally tell us who he is and the. The reporter, Mr. Kleinfield, tracked down old buddies of his, old drinking buddies, who talked about a guy who had died in anonymity. I read it old school, too. I read it in the print edition of the New York Times, and I got to tell you, I couldn't put it down. It was thousands and thousands of words, and I was just going to skim the front page. I had an errand to run. I started reading this piece, and I just read it from top to bottom. I thought it was a piece of brilliant journalism. Mm.
This piece is getting a lot of attention. The New York Times recently ran a story. Readers respond to this piece. And we've been talking about doing a show just about all of the people who die alone in this country.
Well, I think it probably, and according to the Times readers, I think it probably caused a number of people who are living alone at a certain age to maybe give it a thought and maybe reappraise. And I read the one comment from someone in his 80s, a lone wolf, who was living by himself, quite comfortable. Mm. After reading that piece, I take it he has reconsidered and will be moving in with his daughter. So, I mean, when journalism can do that kind of, can have that kind of effect, it just shows you what a remarkable piece this was. Mm.
And we will put a link to that story, to The Lonely Death of George Beall, in the New York Times. And that is Tim Harper. He is national affairs columnist with Canada's Toronto Star. And we'll put links to all of these stories at yourcallradio.org. So let's dive in and talk about the elections in Canada, which are still getting attention here in the United States. The New York Times has been covering this all week, and the national media have been covering this all week. So Justin Trudeau's Liberal Party victory has been getting a lot of attention. Canadian voters ousted Prime Minister Stephen Harper from power. He's held that post for almost 10 years. So many people were surprised about the outcome. And I've heard people interviewed say that things really changed just 2 weeks before the election. Is that about right, Tim?
This happens in many elections, obviously, that a tide turns. First off, thanks for the attention. We appreciate it. We don't get much. This was always going to be an election about change. Stephen Harper could not put the economy and security as the ballot question as he had tried, because there was just an awful fatigue in this country about his government, his style of government, which appeared to Canadians 6 out of 10, 6, 7 out of 10 polls said that they wanted change. They were tired of an autocratic, rather mean-spirited, divisive style of government, and that they wanted their country back. So it was going to come down, it seemed, to a very tight race for the center progressive vote between Justin Trudeau's Liberals and the New Democratic Party, the Social Democrats, led by a Quebec MP by the name of Thomas Mulcair. And Mulcair's party has never held power in this country, but actually led in the polls going into the election. But as the long campaign, and I know you will find this quaint, but it was 78 days.
Yeah.
And we found that quite long in Canada. It played to Trudeau's strength because any doubts about him were essentially eliminated during the length of the campaign. The Harper Conservatives had run an extensive advertising campaign to tell us that he was not ready. Over the course of 78 days, it became apparent that he was ready. And he did snatch that mantle of the change agent away from Mulcair and the New Democrats probably within the last 2 weeks, and then all the dominoes fell in place in the last week. And lo and behold, he had gone from 36 seats as a third party to 184 seats, a majority in our system. The greatest comeback for a party in Canadian political history.
So a lot of us are getting a crash course about politics in Canada. I mean, a 78-day election, we can only dream about that. I also didn't realize that Canada has no term limits.
No, we have no term limits, but it seems like voters, it's almost as if we don't need them. There seems to be a 10-year wall in this country that where politicians can't bust through that 10-year barrier, certainly not in recent history. A couple of previous prime ministers stepped aside at around the same time that perhaps Stephen Harper should have. Brian Mulroney and Jean Chrétien both took the exit ramp and turned the party over to new leaders before reading the writing on the wall. Stephen Harper decided he had one more campaign in him. It's a tall order to ask Canadians for another 4 years when you're verging on the decade mark. And in this case, the status quo maintaining where we were just wasn't going to work. And the campaign really went off the rails. At the end, he was reduced to playing sort of a game show host thing with fake cash register bells to try to show what the cost of the alleged Trudeau tax hikes were. And the final Saturday of the campaign, he spent it at a rally with Rob Ford, the notorious crack-smoking former mayor of Toronto, which was widely seen as a desperation move to try to shore up support there, and it didn't work.
That is Tim Harper. He is a national affairs columnist with Canada's Toronto Star. We're discussing media coverage of the election in Canada, and we're also joined by Andrew Coburn, Washington editor with Harper's Magazine and author of Kill Chain, The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins. And what did you think of coverage of Canada's election? It's still getting attention in the United States. As Tim said, we don't get much coverage of Canada's politics here in the U.S. So what are you learning about not only Justin Trudeau, but how things have really changed in Canada under Stephen Harper? If anything struck you in the media this week about this issue, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Andrew, what are your thoughts on this? A lot of people are comparing this election to our election in 2008, when George W. Bush, his time was out, and then Barack Obama won.
Yes, I mean, I hope the comparison doesn't run too far, because you know, right after the election of Obama, we all started to, people who've been tremendously cheered about it started to get a little disappointed as policies we hope would be put into effect actually weren't. Nevertheless, I mean, yeah, I can see the parallel is very hopeful, especially as Mr. Trudeau, I think he probably means what what he says he's going to do, he probably can do, because, unlike here, where Obama was faced with a pretty truculent Congress, I mean, he controls the parliament. So, and it's, as Paul Krugman pointed out, I think in today's New York Times, it's very hopeful because, Canada so often leads the way or, shows us the way we should go, like with, the healthcare system and so forth. Now he says he's going to, Trudeau is promised to abandon the sort of half-baked, sort of idiotic, really, sort of austerity policies that Harper was so pledged to. And, you know, he's pulling out of the wars in the Middle East. He looks like he'll have a very good environmental record, you know, environmental policy, although he's got this rather demented liberal prime minister in British Columbia who's all for mining everywhere. So I'm tremendously bucked, particularly because, you know, as you've probably gathered, I spent a lot of my time thinking about defense. And, you know, Trudeau has pledged to not buy the F-35, which is this absolute boondoggle of a fighter plane that the Americans are building, and they'd hope to rope the Canadians. Were sort of, Harper had indicated he probably would, although he hadn't, would sign a contract to buy some. So for those of us who think this way, this is very cheering news that the coalition to build the F-35 may be falling apart. I mean, that's a parochial interest. Well, not so parochial. It's many billions of dollars at stake. And of course, the other thing was, I should say, about the press coverage is probably to most Americans came as a big surprise that the Canadians had had an election, because coverage of Canada is, you know, lamentably thin. Coverage of anywhere is getting pretty thin in the U.S. media, but none more so than Canada.
Why do you think that is, Andrew?
Yeah, it's a sort of parochialism. It's sort of certain arrogance. You know, there's this sort of mindset that Canada's kind of boring, and you know, we don't need to pay much attention to their kind of inferior versions of America. I mean, I think it's ludicrous, and Canada's a very interesting place with some very, very interesting politics, as everyone now has to admit right this week. But I think that's it, and then that's coupled with, as I just said, indicated, a general decline of overseas coverage in the American media. McClatchy just announced it's closing all its overseas bureaus. I mean, which were actually some of the better foreign coverage we were getting from them.
All of their bureaus.
All of their foreign bureaus. To concentrate on regional issues. It's some demented executive decision.
Wow.
So, you know, the lights are going out, and Americans are sort of more and more deprived of sensible, you know, of experience. You know, there's a lot of coverage, and there's very, very good stuff done by people like Vice, you know. Vice News, I think, is excellent, and, you know, the very gutsy reporting we get from them. And other, you know, internet-based stuff. But, I mean, there's no substitute, really, for people, you know, experienced foreign, knowledgeable foreign correspondents, you know, old-school media, people who've been there a long time and really understand what's going on. And we're getting less and less and less of that.
You know, this is kind of shocking for us to learn, because we've had McClatchy reporters on the show on a regular basis, and I was just looking this up. The Huffington Post has a piece about this, and it looks like Dion Nissenbaum, a former McClatchy reporter who's now at the Wall Street Journal, tweeted, "End of era coming from McClatchy. Sources say company poised to close its foreign bureaus amid broader shakeup at the D.C. bureau." This follows news that the amazing reporter Jonathan Landay, who actually asked real questions in the run-up to the U.S. invasion of Iraq, recently announced he's leaving McClatchy to go to Reuters. So maybe that explains his decision.
Yes, I think so. I mean, he's a really terrific reporter, Landay. And they've also got Hannah Alam, who's in the D.C. bureau. She's great. I hope, maybe she'll be leaving too. I don't know. I mean, Reuters, I've got to say, does do some very interesting, has some great, good reporting. I should have mentioned, when you were asking for News Story of the Week, there was a terrific piece about Iraq on the Reuters site this week by Ned Barker, who was their Baghdad correspondent until he had to flee and, I think, leave in the face of threats from the Shia militias. Anyone who wants to know what's going on in Iraq should look up Reuters Ned Barker this week. Anyway, yeah. So as I said, the lights are going out all over.
And so, since we're talking about this, Tim, what about Canada's major papers? Are you getting much coverage of what's happening overseas? And do Canada's major papers have bureaus overseas?
Well, no. Sadly, the same situation is playing out north of your border here. Back to the just for a second, you know, the comments about the Canadian coverage. Excuse me. When I was based in Washington, I wrote a piece, I think, about 2007 or 2008, marking the last newspaper to pull their U.S. paper to pull their Canadian correspondent out. You know, 10 or 15 years ago, every large newspaper, it may not have been the sexiest posting, but they had somebody based in Toronto. And they often combined it with coverage out of New York and so on. But, you know, as Andrew points out, there's no substitute for being somewhere and understanding and living the nuances of the story as opposed to firefighting. Now, we have maintained our bureau in Washington as a Canadian newspaper, and we are the largest. You have to have somebody in Washington because of the obvious reasons, the depth and the value of the bilateral relationship, but also just because of the immense volume of news that comes out of Washington that is of interest and relevance to Canadians. But every other large newspaper, it seems, we have closed in recent years bureaus in London and in Moscow and in Beijing and elsewhere. So we may be the largest in terms of circulation, but we, in fact, have a Washington bureau, and that's all we have left.
Mm. Tim Harper is national affairs columnist with Canada's Toronto Star. He's spent 2 decades covering politics in Canada, another 6 years in Washington, D.C., covering politics. And Andrew Coburn is Washington editor with Harper's Magazine and the author of Kill Chain, The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins. And Tim, a couple more questions about media coverage of the elections in Canada. What are your thoughts? And I feel like it's gotten some really good coverage in terms of Justin Trudeau, who he is, how things have changed under Harper. The alternative media has also done a good job. And Judy Rebick, founder of Rabble.ca, one of Canada's leading independent sites, told Democracy Now! That the Liberals in Canada have a long history of running on the left and governing on the right. And she was talking about trade, for example. The Liberals have campaigned against trade, and then once they get into power, they actually embrace trade. What are your thoughts on that and how that's been covered?
Oh, well, Judy's right. We're going to have to, again, see how this plays out, but one of the stories of this campaign was how Trudeau's Liberals outflanked the NDP on the left. Mm-hmm. You talked about the austerity measures that the conservatives here in this country have been worshiping at the balanced budget altar for years, and they got the New Democrats, the most progressive party, to do the same thing. They pledged balanced budgets as well, which left a wide open route for Trudeau to speak of running deficits for 3 years, which should not be heresy. But under 9.5 years of conservative rule, and initially it sounded like heresy. So they are the ones who are going to tax the rich. They are the ones that are going to run the deficits. They are the ones who are under Trudeau who really grabbed the urgency of what Canadian voters wanted. They want to change, and they want it now. However, historically, Judy Rebick's absolutely right, and see this just by going through campaign promises versus reality, that they do routinely campaign from the left and govern from the center. The old story about the campaign poetry turning into the government prose, it's quite pronounced under Liberal governments. So, I covered that Obama campaign in 2008. There was a lot of hope, and it didn't really matter what his platform was. There's a lot of hope invested in Justin Trudeau, and some of the exit polling and analysis shows really very little understanding of what he was pitching. So,
and Tim, hold that thought.
Room to move back to the center.
We're going to take a quick break. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we will have a conversation with economist Richard Wolff about rising inequality in the United States. He says the first step in understanding income and wealth inequalities is to grasp a basic truth about modern capitalist economic systems. So what are alternative solutions for reversing inequality and stagnant wages? Next week, we are also putting shows together about the 11 propositions in San Francisco. I hope everyone's going to vote. We've got 11 very important props coming up. We just had a debate about Prop F, which would regulate short-term rentals. That was a couple days ago, and you can find it at yourcallradio.org. And then we are also putting shows together about renewable energy in California and the campaign to keep oil and gas in the ground. Today, it is our media roundtable. And we're speaking with Tim Harper, National Affairs columnist with Canada's Toronto Star, and Andrew Coburn, Washington editor with Harper's and author of Kill Chain, The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins. And Tim, right before we let you go, just a couple more questions about coverage of the election. A lot of people are asking about Keystone XL, and Newsweek had a piece, the headline is Justin Trudeau, Canada's new prime minister, has close ties to Keystone, saying that Trudeau has refused to take a definitive position on Canada's proposed $12 billion Energy East pipeline, which would carry about a million barrels of tar sand, but he is in favor of it, right?
He's in favor of Keystone. Your listeners probably won't be surprised to hear that pipeline politics has been front and center in this country for some years now. The difference between he and Stephen Harper is that Justin Trudeau is not going to cheerlead for Keystone. He's not going to allow it to define the relationship between Washington and Ottawa, which Stephen Harper did. Barack Obama, Justin Trudeau understands that the Keystone decision is a domestic decision that the U.S. president will make. However, Barack Obama would be doing him a huge favor if he pronounced one way or the other, yea or nay, and got this off the table under a Trudeau government, because it really did get in the way of Canada-U.S. relations. Stephen Harper and Barack Obama were never really a comfortable fit. And the longer that the Keystone was still sitting there, the frostier this relationship got.
And Andrew, do you have any questions for Tim about media coverage of the election?
Well, no. I mean, I've learned so much about the election in the last 20 minutes that I'm very grateful for that. I'm interested in what way he thinks, beyond Keystone, beyond the tar sands, what we can expect from Trudeau about the environment in general. Like, I know mining is certainly in Western Canada is a huge issue. How he thinks he will play that?
Well, I think Americans actually should be heartened somewhat by the removal of Harper. Stephen Harper, there's a huge pile of Fossil of the Year awards on the Canadian mantelpiece because of the rather backward environmental pro-oil policy of Stephen Harper. Trudeau is not a radical environmentalist, and he didn't get elected on that. But he has pledged, for starters, to take all 10 provincial premiers with him to the Paris summit, and to leave it to the provinces when it comes to cap and trade and environmental policy, but to lead and to set targets, and that's something that Stephen Harper wouldn't do. So I think in terms of a continent-wide move on the environment, I think the U.S. Will and should welcome a fresher view on that from Justin Trudeau than what we endured under Stephen Harper.
And we have a few callers on this. Let's go to April in Berkeley. Hi, April. Welcome to the show.
Hi there.
Hi, go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes, you're fine. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay, great. I just wanted to comment in response to an earlier caller who said that Americans find Canadian politics boring. And as a baby boomer in the Bay Area, I have to say that many of us have always considered Canada our last refuge, whether we're running from the draft and to the Vietnam War, or ever every time a conservative is voted in here at the United States in the White House, many of us are saying, that's it, I'm moving to Canada. And I think with the upcoming elections here, the prospects for the direction of the United States are, it's not looking too great, and the election of Trudeau was really great news to hear, and it's also, I think, in line with what's going on in other parts of the world with the turnover in Spain and places like that. So I think I've been reading about it in the New York Times, and I've found it really quite intriguing to see that progressive politics is not dead in North America.
Well, thank you for calling in. And Tim, before we let you go, I mean, the other issue is Indigenous people. The AP had a piece with the headline, Canada Elects Trudeau, Record Number of Aboriginals to Parliament. And they report that the election saw a record-breaking 54 First Nation candidates run for office. Indigenous people will end up occupying only 3% of the 338 seats in Canada's House of Commons. But a lot of people, a lot of Indigenous people that I've heard in the media this week say this is actually a victory because he will actually spend time on the murdered and missing Indigenous women issue, which Harper ignored.
He has pledged to convene an inquiry into the murdered and missing Aboriginal women. The NDP would have done the same. Stephen Harper maintained that it was a criminal matter and that there was nothing to be gained from an inquiry. This will be a cathartic moment for First Nations in this country. It's something that I think needs to be done. It's something that has been called for a couple of years. And that's one promise that Justin Trudeau cannot break, and I think it'll be one of his priorities.
Well, Tim, thank you so much for joining us. And maybe like 6 months into Trudeau becoming prime minister, we'd love to do a show to find out how he's doing in this new job.
I'd love to do that, and I appreciate you calling.
All right. Thank you, Tim. Tim Harper is national affairs columnist with Canada's Toronto Star. He spent 2 decades there covering politics and 6 years in Washington covering politics. You can find his reporting at yourcallradio.org. And sticking with us for the rest of the hour is Andrew Coburn, Washington editor with Harper's Magazine and the author of Kill Chain, The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins. And earlier this week, Intercept published an explosive story about President Obama's assassination policy between 2011 and 2013. And the documents were provided by a source within the intelligence community. And Andrew, you have a piece in Harper's that just came out. And first off, this source told Intercept, according to the piece that Jeremy Scahill wrote, that he provided these documents because he believes the public has a right to understand the process by which people are placed on kill lists and assassinated on orders from the highest echelons of the U.S. government. I mean, you wrote a book about this, Kill Chain, The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins. What is new in these documents?
What's new? I mean, broadly, we knew what was going on and the sort of various technologies, you know, the means by which this sort of this campaign was being carried on. What's very good is to in these documents, and it is a, you know, it's excellent that they've appeared, is that we actually see the mindset. This is how they think about it, the language they use, the you know, the whole bureaucratic, what I call the bureaucracy of murder, so laid out, including all the various different stages by which, you know, the baseball card, basically, which is what they call it, what we learn from the documents, is a little card when they want to kill someone. They put the sort of details of who he is and why he should be killed and where he is and so forth. And that makes its way up through this chain, ultimately to the Oval Office, apart from the times when it doesn't, when they, because as we also, you know, the documents give some nice number, or not nice, horrible numbers, on the number of times they kill people, or they have killed in some specific instances, killed people who they didn't know they were. So he talks about a campaign in called Operation Haymaker, which was in end of 2012, beginning 2013 in northeast Afghanistan. And early on, they'd killed 200 people, of whom 35 were people they were actually meaning to kill, were actual designated targets that had been on the baseball cards. The rest of them, they didn't know who they were. Mm. So they put them down as EKIA, enemy killed in action, which means that they basically they killed someone and posthumously sort of promoted them to militant. Didn't really sort of matter who they were. I think documents don't say so. I think this is a product of the famous signature strikes when they, you know, they see something, someone who looks like a, you know, what they consider a terrorist and walks like a terrorist, etc. So they just kill him. They have various, you know, algorithms that describe what a target should look like, and if someone corresponds to that, then they press the button and off he goes. He goes, or child goes.
Right. Well, and according to these documents, so these are documents that look at the assassination policy between 2011 and 2013. And according to these documents, during 1 5-month period between January 2012 and February 2013, nearly 90% of the people killed in airstrikes were not the intended targets. And you have written about this extensively in the past.
Yes. Well, I mean, there's various things, you know, you've got to understand in this, which is, you know, that the drone technology, and this is I'm afraid this has been a problem on the sort of among critics of the whole thing as well as supporters. I mean, drone technology isn't quite what they say it is. I mean, it's very one reason for that astonishing number, you know, percentage you just quoted. Why it's not astonishing, really, is that the technology is very inefficient. I mean, the drones don't see very well. As I reported in my book and other places, that they, under certain conditions, i.e. at night, the infrared sensor has a visual acuity of 20 over 200, which, you know, we hit 20/20 vision, as you know, is perfect vision. Well, 20 over 200 is very imperfect. Perfect vision. In fact, it fits the legal definition of blindness for drivers according to DMVs in this country. So we have legally blind sensors picking out who they should kill. So no wonder you get, you know, 90% are not on the target list. The other reason these pictures are blurry so much of the time is, it's worth knowing, it sounds a bit wonkish, but I point out in this Harper's piece, is that, you know, they have to be transmitted across oceans and continents back to the button pushers in Nevada or, you know, Fort Bragg or the Pentagon or Langley or wherever, all these different people who are sitting waging war by remote control. And there's a question of bandwidth comes up. I mean, this is an enormous amount of information which has to go through the whole satellite system. And that's, you know, restricted. I mean, they spend a gigantic amount just renting space from commercial carriers just to transmit all this, and the information flow is still limited. So that's why you don't get sharp, you know, high definition pictures most of the time. You get, contrary to what you see on, you know, in the movies like Good Kill and so forth, you get very blurry pictures. I mean, it's all these constraints you have to understand if you want to know what's going on.
After the publication of the documents, Jeremy Scahill went on Democracy Now! And said one of the most significant findings is that we published the kill chain, what the bureaucracy of assassination looks like. He said, what you see is that all of these officials, including people like the Treasury Secretary, are part of signing off on all of this, where they have these secret meetings and they discuss who's going to live and die around the world. And at the end of that process, it's the President of the United States who signs what amounts to a death warrant for whoever they've decided should die.
Well, that's right, although I question how much time. Well, Obama, you know, Obama, he likes to talk about playing the Wurlitzer. He's, you know, it's like, you know, he's the organ player manipulating all these covert operations. He's into this stuff. I had a quote in my book about how turned out after he just killed someone a few years back, it was an American, Amiral Alaki, he came back, he'd been called out of a meeting with his political aides, and he came back in and he said, turns out I'm really good at killing people. Who would have thought it? Mm. You know, it's one of the things, I guess, after you spent a day arguing with, you know, the Republicans in the House or something, it's quite nice for him to be able to sort of push a button and get something done, kill someone half a world away. So, yeah, I should say, by the way, the kill chain, it's in the military, it's an established military phrase. They're not talking about things going all the way up to the president. They're talking about the chain of actions you have to go through once you've decided to hit a target. Anyway, but that's a quibble. But yes, but we kind of knew this. It's great that we have finally the official document sort of laying it out. But what I read the documents in a slightly different way, maybe from Jeremy Scahill. I mean, not to detract from the achievement of getting them and publishing them, but to me, as I say in my Harper's piece, that what they really represent to me is a plea for money. I mean, clearly, if you read the documents, if you know what goes on in the Pentagon and how the system works, the fact that they admit in the documents, they say, oh, you know, that we were doing a campaign, and, you know, after a couple of months, we'd only, you know, most of the people were still alive. And, you know, so often we're unable to finish, which is one of their euphemisms for killing someone, because they talk about find, fix, finish, and finishing really means finishing someone off. And we miss a finish because, you know, we don't have enough drones on target, so we need more, you know, message, we need more drones. Mm-hmm. You know, in East Africa, in Somalia, and in Yemen, the drones have to go long distances from their bases, so we don't have enough drones. You know, we don't have drones overhead all the time. So implicit message, send us more, you know, we need more money for more drones. They say we don't have, you know, one of the things we need, or we really, really need, is HD FMV, which means high definition full motion video, which is what I was just talking about. So that really can be translated into more expensive cameras and more satellite space, more bandwidth. So it's really, they talk about in one point about the drones, you know, having to go a long way to get to Somalia, and one of the authors of the slides has called it, because this is a series of PowerPoint slides is what we're talking about. One of the slide authors has talked about the tyranny of distance. And I was talking to a friend of mine who spent years in the Pentagon listening to sort of presentations of this kind. He said, oh, God, he said, anyone whoever dreamt up that tyranny of distance phrase deserves promotion to four-star rank immediately. He said that could cost us $10 billion on the budget, no problem.
Wow.
So that's, you know, yes, you know, it is chilling to see the, you know, murder by, you know, PowerPoint laid out like this. But you have to understand it's very important to understand why these documents get produced this way and what they're really saying.
Hmm. I'm speaking with Andrew Coburn, Washington editor with Harper's Magazine and author of Kill Chain, The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins. We're talking about media coverage of the documents that were leaked to The Intercept about President Obama's assassination policy between 2011 and 2013. And if you have any thoughts about media coverage on this, so Jeremy Scahill was interviewed on Democracy Now! And NPR. I'm pretty sure it was Morning Edition. That's where I heard him. And Truthdig, Business Insider, Foreign Policy, Huffington Post, Mother Jones, a lot of alternative papers focused on this. And then some of the national papers ran op-eds, like the Sacramento Bee, for example, which is a McClatchy paper. But overall, Andrew, what was your take on the media's coverage of these leaked documents?
Well, it was inadequate, I would say. The usual... The coverage was a roundup of the usual suspects, as you mentioned, Democracy Now!, you know, which spends a lot of time dealing with this. But I was surprised they didn't make more of an impact. I think it's partly, you know, the mainstream, the New York Times, doesn't like to give any kind of promotion to this kind of mingy, sort of pissy outfit they are, really. They don't like to give coverage to someone else's scoop unless they really, really have to. No one in Congress spoke up about it because, you know, the drone program is quite popular in Congress. I mean, I think it really was an illustration of the sort of poverty of discourse, poverty of politics in this country, that there wasn't more coverage of this. It's partly, I have to say, it was partly because, you know, there weren't huge surprises. I mean, supposing the documents had revealed that, in fact, Obama wasn't making the decision, that it was up to the local commander to decide who to kill, which I think is what actually goes on a lot of the time, that would have been a surprise. If there'd been a figure in that, if they'd admitted in the slides the number of instead of just saying, you know, EKIA, that euphemism, you know, acronym for we don't know who we kill, if they had a number for the number of women and children they kill, which they probably do know but take great care not to write down, that might have got greater play, but generally it was pretty disappointing.
Wired magazine compared the leaked documents to the massive troves of information leaked by Edward Snowden. The magazine called its piece a second Snowden, and Edward Snowden has called this the biggest national security leak of the year. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's probably, Snowden's probably right, but I mean, on the other hand, we haven't had that many national security leaks. I would say it's not really on a par with Snowden because, I don't want to sort of sound like I'm, you know, dissing the leak, but it's, Snowden gave us a huge array of documents really detailing not just what they were up to in terms of surveillance, but illegal things they were up to in terms of surveillance. I mean, things they'd lied about continually. And then Snowden took the very courageous decision to be a living, talking witness to all this. So he's been on, you know, given countless interviews, commenting on explaining what these things mean. These documents, I mean, valuable though they are, didn't do that. It'd be great if the source were to sacrifice his career and everything else to go on TV and explain, you know, to talk about the slides and what else there are. I mean, it'd be very, very interesting. One thing we could pray for is we get, you know, these slides talk specifically about the Joint Special Operations Command assassination program. What we also need, of course, is an equivalent whistleblower from the CIA. From the CIA program, which we know much less about. I mean, very specifically targeted on assassinations in various places. And it'd be very interesting to have someone, you know, either these ones talk about the budget fights that go on between them. I mean, the military and the CIA compete for the mission. And in fact, this is the CIA's reason that everything keeps coming as a big surprise to the CIA, like, they didn't learn about the Russian bombing campaign in Syria until it happened, is that this, you know, assassination has become their number one mission these days.
And so now that we do have these documents and reporting on drones, how do you think the media should report on drones from here on out? I mean, do we know even about the drone policy that's taking place today? Because these documents were about what was happening between 2011 and 2013.
Well, I mean, one of the very interesting pieces, and in fact, the thing that people ought to really concentrate on in the Intercept documents that they published was a chapter by Nick Turse, who talking about what's going on in Africa, and in a way, or you know, the tremendous expansion that's happened in the last 2 years of drone operations in Africa, which, in a way, perhaps I should say this that they. You know, I say the drone documents mostly represent a plea for money, and what's going on in Africa is really, you know, the Turse's reporting is, you know, that plea being answered because, they're getting drone bases really all the way across Africa, which is not being reported on at all, and the degree to which, you know, we're fighting this covert drone war now much more in Africa than a few years ago. So that's one thing the media should be looking into much more.
And what about the budget? Does the money spent on drones, does that stand out in the budget?
Well, you see, it's hidden in plain sight. A lot of it, you know, you can say, well, a drone costs so-and-so much, and they try and pretend it's much cheaper than a manned fighter plane, which is not really the case. Hmm. A Reaper drone, costs around $20 million. But, you know, you have to cost in the huge apparatus that's been built up around the drones. I mean, the whole, they have these stations across the country, common ground distribution systems, which is, I've been in one, it's these huge, huge, like a vast sort of Wall Street trading room with hundreds of young people in uniform sitting looking at monitors, looking at screens, and they're looking at all the drone pictures from and reconnaissance pictures from all over the world. They can access any of them, and they're really running drone strikes or helping to run drone strikes. They're in communication with, you know, the drone pilots in Nevada, and it's a vast, staggeringly vast, and each of these things costs $750 million, each of these stations, and there are five of them across the country, a couple more overseas. So there's a huge infrastructure, and actually many more than five, come to think of it, a huge infrastructure around drone operations. That it's really a vast budget. So the media should really be looking into that.
And
the media should be looking at the whole mystique of drones. You know,
right. Well, and I wonder, I'm guessing that from here on out, with Jim Webb and Lincoln Chafee dropping out of the Democratic presidential election, Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton will most likely be the two on stage. And I wonder if they'll ask questions about drones. And for the record, you've reported that in 2010, then Secretary of State says she believes drones are a key component of U.S. strategy. Bernie Sanders recently on Meet the Press says that he drones are terrible and counterproductive, but he would use them against key terrorists. And they didn't ask him to elaborate, so we don't really know what that
means.
Yeah.
Very. Wasn't that interesting? So don't expect any change from Bernie Sanders. You know,
right.
In fact, his foreign policy, and for another time, but I find Bernie Sanders' views on foreign policy pretty disheartening.
Well, we'd love to have you back on that topic, Andrew. Andrew Coburn is Washington editor with Harper's Magazine and author of Kill Chain, The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins. You can find his piece just out in Harper's about drones. Thank you for joining us again, Andrew.
Harper's Online, I should say.
Harper's Online, yes. We'll link to it. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with economist Richard Wolff about rising inequality. The top 20% of U.S. households own more than 84% of the wealth. Wolff says that the first step in understanding income and wealth inequalities is to grasp a basic truth about modern capitalist economic systems. So what do we need to know about how capitalism contributes to the growing economic crisis? And what are the alternative solutions for reversing inequality and stagnant wages? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar. And you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Debbie Kennedy is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.